Ramsey Lewis and his band with Wade in the Water, the title track of his 1966 album that is a smash hit to this day. Lewis, an award-winning jazz pianist, composer, arranger, and performer, has recorded more than 80 albums. He's still going strong at 83. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And it's time to free your mind, for crying out loud. Why? Because it's Free Your Mind Friday, that's why. And we all know what we do on Free Your Mind Friday. We express ourselves. We express our opinions. It's not important whether you think people will agree or disagree, as they very well might. But it is about you expressing your opinion about something. And of course, people might take you on, but fear ye not. We are a well-mannered and friendly folk here. We may disagree, but we do it nicely. 888-874-4888 is the number you call, and we get started with whatever it is you have to say. Lots and lots and lots to talk about, but this is your time, not mine. I'm just a traffic cop, and from time to time, I'm going to prod you and poke you to get you moving in the direction that I can sense you want to go. So that's my job. But other than that, it's your opinions that will guide us. This is our open forum that we have every week, and we devote this time to talking out loud. This is one of the best ways to use radio. And I'm so glad that at PRN, that has been a major focus, getting people to talk and express their views, getting them involved, getting them connected to each other, even if they disagree. Because, you know, push comes to shove, we all are, in one way or another, representatives of a school of thought, if you will, that contrasts with many people's way of thinking out here. And it is always a good thing to be able to defend your position. You don't have to just capitulate. A part of what it is we do every single day as we interact with people is we have an opportunity to interact with them in a meaningful way. And you never know, sometimes just a few minutes talking with a person would get them thinking, and vice versa. You may begin to say, well, wait a minute, I used to think A, but you know, that person makes some sense. So maybe I should recheck my position. Anyway, that's what Free Your Mind Friday is all about. 888-874-4888. It would be great if you can give us a nice, tight presentation. In other words, don't wander off into 15 different directions. Stay focused on your point and follow it through. Okay. So that's where we are starting today. I want to thank so many of you for just the wonderful notes of encouragement and back at you, you know. In life, we're all going through all kinds of challenges, and sometimes just a little word does a lot. It goes a long way to get people to all bolstered up to face life's daily challenges. All right, who is next? Who's up first? I should say not next, but who's up first? I don't see anybody. Okay, so until we get the first person calling in, I want to impress upon you that this is going to be a very, very significant week ahead. Certainly it has been already for this week. The president has gone off the rails. He's begun this trade war with China. And you get the sense, you know, I'm worried, not because he did it. It is not an unexpected thing. If we go back to the idea of the president has been showing all the signs of a mentally unstable person, I keep saying that, and every effort is being made to cover it up, but he is a mentally unstable person, and many of his cabinet members are emulating his psychological profile, behaving grotesquely, developing it's becoming more and more authoritarian, and that's a nice kind word to use instead of saying a very neo-Nazi kind of administration. Concerned with inflicting pain on people, eliminating the defective ones, that's the ones who aren't wealthy beyond belief, who don't have a lot of money, who are basically on the bottom rung. They have no sympathy for people like that. And in their own way, they're proceeding with a program that one could only describe as a program of attrition, just clearing the decks of useless people who are picking up space in the universe and consuming the benefits that they're not entitled to. But I accepted from the very beginning, and I shared that with the audience, we need to understand that this president is mentally unstable, no question about it in my mind. And we see it in so many ways in which this administration has proposed to enact policies and carry out policies that are, in effect, anti-human and race and class conscious. That's really crazy. So I'm not surprised by anything that Donald Trump is prone to do, including just one day waking up and deciding, hey, let's go to war. Let's have a nice little war. I've been dreaming of a little war. And we learned just recently that his sights were set on Venezuela. But what is concerning is that while this is developing, and it should trouble any sane person in this country, there are no calls yet, except from the group of psychiatrists who have been sidelined and just dismissed, their views that Trump is unstable. Disturbingly unstable. And you wonder, at a time like this, when the voices should be loudest in order to prevent it from things from getting even worse, we have nothing but silence and, in fact, adulation. That is very scary. That in the face of something that we can easily now, there's no doubt that we can question his mental acuity, there is deafening silence and, in fact, complicity at a level we haven't seen before. Well, except in Nazi Germany, where Hitler could do no wrong. Mussolini, he could do no wrong, even though he was doing wrong. E from Edgewater, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you today, Trace?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm doing all right. We're all hanging in there, right? Do the best we can.
Yep, that's a good plan, to just hang in there.
Yeah.
So what's on your mind today?
Well, since nobody was calling in, I figured I'd call it and clean up a quote that I read about a week ago, maybe a little further back. It was a quote that I read. Maybe I should read the quote again, and I asked you if you knew who said it. So this was the way the quote went. If you can convince the lowest white man that he's better than the best colored man, he won't notice you're picking his pocket. Hell, give him someone to look down on, and they'll empty his pockets for you. And that was the quote. Do you recall?
No, I recall the sentiment of the quote, but I don't know to whom to attribute it.
Okay, it was Lyndon Baines Johnson, and you asked me what year he said that and the context, and I didn't have that information. But now I think I have a little more information on that. He said it in 1960 when he was running for Senate, I guess it was Senate. And he said it to a young Bill Moyers, who was working on his staff at the time. They were driving through a town in Tennessee on a motorcade, and they passed a sign of anti-black graffiti. Didn't say what it said, but later on he commented on it at night to Bill Moyers. Just him and Bill Moyers were left in the room. And he made that quote. So that was the best information I could get on it.
Well, thank you. Very instructive, especially when you place Lyndon B. Johnson, in the context of social and political change in this country, to know his heartfelt sentiments. Very interesting. Thank you.
Right.
Matt,
thank you.
New York, on the air.
Yes, greetings to the beloved family.
Thank you.
Let me see where I should start. There's just so much going on. First of all, I have to agree with you, and it's more than just unstable. He's dangerous. I mean, I would suggest people, you don't have to buy it. You can ask the library to get it. It's called The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. And it's by, it first came together with a Yale conference. At first, the mental health professionals were a bit shy because of that so-called Goldwater rule. But they came together, and I think about 27 of them go into the, was it Gwen who mentioned malignant narcissism, other blamer, and on, and all kinds of deviants, personality disorder, and on and on. It was difficult to put that book down because it was so on point. I also want to share, follow up on something that Gwen said the other day, about the fact that Nazi Germany didn't come about overnight. That was an excellent point. And I have some issues myself with Amy Goodman, because like she won't even deal with 9 September 11, 2001. It's always a pro and con situation. But she did have a good program. I think it was yesterday, where, of course, she had the latest tales. I mean, it gets more bizarre and bizarre in terms of the separation of the children. And it seems that the ICE, which rightfully needs to be abolished, came up after September 11th, 01. And they're supposed to be dealing with high-level crimes. And they were actually putting young children, like 8 and 10 years old, over to the, making them walk to the Mexican side alone, you know, and there are some shelters and people who are aware of this, but this is how, I mean, you just hear one story after another, it gets more bizarre. But the program that Amy had also brought on the journalist who wrote, I think it is A Long Night, and it's on, she's done a lot of research on concentration camps. And I had mentioned at one point about how they are setting up Fort Bliss in Texas. They're setting up these detention centers, big. And she was helping us grasp with the proper definition of a concentration camp, because is most people will think of a place like Auschwitz and they think of it as a extermination a center. However, she explained that that didn't come on immediately. It started as a detention concentration camp, and then through propaganda, putting in certain judges, we just saw that Muslim ban come down from those fools on the Supreme Court. Everybody should see what Sotomayor had to say and about the Karamitsu situation. And basically, through propaganda, changing the, you know, having certain judges in place, and through the legislator, how it was able to become actual extermination camps. And often,
you know,
did say something along those lines.
Here's the thing, and I wanted to seize on the point. A lot of people who are telling these stories are acting as this is new. History tells us we have been here many times before. You would probably not be able to finish a book that tells the story of what happened to the indigenous people and their children and the separation of families back then, or what happened, of course, during slavery. What was that?
Excellent,
it's fashionable now for
point.
Us to talk about this, but we have been through several cycles of this, and it's still ongoing. They haven't finished the programs directed at these vulnerable communities, which is why I keep saying we are in the midst of it, and we still refuse to see it. This has been going on for centuries. It happens that it is politically expedient now, because Donald Trump, being a racist, is seeing the value in mining racist attitudes and sowing racist attitudes in this country. And this is a perfect way to do it. But we have been through this many times before. The Japanese, the Africans coming here, it's still not finished. They're still not finished. You go through parts of the South and you can't begin to explain what is happening here to this day. You go through some of the big cities and you cannot explain the concentration camps that have developed by design. I did a whole thing about Ferguson and how it became a sundown town.
Mm.
You know, we've been through this. So this is not new. This is the sad part, that we think it is new. It is not new.
And if I could just button my comment with the title, because she does go into examples that it isn't new. The book is called One Long Night, A Global History of Concentration Camps. And she has an article at the Daily Beast. I think it's called History Lesson, how Gitmo started a detention camp in holding immigrants when the Cubans and Haitians were coming over on a boat at one point. They surrounded them so they couldn't touch U.S. soil. And that's how Gitmo, you know, as a naval base, they were there until there were riots and, you know, a child died and all kinds of atrocities and all. And so I think it would be worthwhile to look at her work and her articles. Her name is Pitzer, P-I-T-Z-E-R, and Andrea, because she was making your exact same point. She gives an example of in France during World War II, where they wound up putting people as the war was winding down, the German Jews were coming in, and they also had the German prisoners, and they wound up deporting those people. And of course, you know, people wound up getting slaughtered when they were sent back. So you're absolutely right. I'll continue to listen. Love you and love your program.
Thank you very much, and thanks for your contribution today. Jeff from New Jersey, what's going on?
Ain't nothing much. Getting a little sprinkle here there, but I think the sun's about to try to come out. I want to make 2 points. One is about Donald and his group of crazies up there. I think they're not actually following his lead. I think that they were, because during the Bush era, both Bushes, these guys were in, a lot of these guys were Bolton and a couple other guys were in positions where they couldn't really make decisions that would affect us nationally. And that was on purpose because they were called the crazies. And now these crazies actually have come to power, and they are put in positions where now they're going to affect each other, just as what Bolton did to try to sabotage the talks with North Korea. Right before he's going to say, we're going to do the Libya model on North Korea. That's, you know, it's insane. You're undercutting your president, actually, who was trying to do whatever he was trying to get his hotels built over there. But I just think that there's, you know, he's not leading the crazies. They may actually be leading him. He's just a real pliable character that will go the way that benefits him the most. And along with his racism, yes, indeed, and his thoughts that he is much smarter than he actually is. And those are the dangerous combinations. But I want to talk about something on a little more on the building side. And that would be Alexandria Ocasio-Castro, I guess I think her name is, that won the congressional seat. And
yes,
what we can do to help her. And my neighbors to the east of me in New York, if you have a congressional person or congressional seat that's up, you need to surround the other barrels with a candidate that's much like her. She's not going to get too much done in Washington. We talked about this earlier in the week, but she won't get too much done in Washington because she's outside of the party. But what she can do is concentrate on helping the people, her constituents, and the islands in which her constituents come from. Because, you know, there's a lot of Jamaicans and Dominicans and Puerto Ricans and Haitians in her district, imagine it. So those, her efforts should be on maybe helping to concentrate and help those people to recover any islands, find a way to have them avoid this land grab that's getting ready to happen or that's happening. Whether they maintain their property through taxes, whatever they do, but set up programs for them to be able to return to the islands once things are clear. And that should keep her in a good position until we can surround her with other candidates from New York, New Jersey that she has something in common with, and constituents that have things in common. You know, so I don't know if that makes any sense to you, what I'm saying.
Well, it's a tall order, that's for sure. This is what it is I was talking about when I talked about the fact that, especially operating outside of the Democratic Party, those parties that had the opportunity to build critical mass to support a candidate like her didn't, and instead sold out.
Right.
Imagine the clout that she would have been able to go into Congress with if it were known, say, the Green Party supported her wholeheartedly while she worked with Bernie Sanders. But I mean a wholehearted endorsement, full-throated endorsement of her. And some Democrats also should have crossed over a little bit and said, you know, that they welcome her or something. But they're not doing that. They're still back in the old days of stupid politics. And we'll get stupid politics for at least another 4 years. but she's in a situation where it's going to be a great challenge for her. You're right. And the question is, how do people make it easier for her? We don't know.
I think you set up things at home, the things that need to be done in New York. And one of the things in New York is that you have a large number of independent voters who are not registered as Democrats or Republicans or anything. So she does have some clout, but that has to be shown by electing whatever the district is next to her. She's got the Bronx and Brooklyn, Bronx and Queens.
Queens,
the districts in Brooklyn and in Manhattan, those independent voters need to go out and elect people who are out there pressing hands like she was and working hard like she was and had the same issues. Because, throughout New York, it's pretty much common what the issues are there. So she can work on things actually in the neighborhood, which will sustain her for 4 years until we can get someone or get other people from the New York to be the leader from New York and places where there are a large Caribbean communities. And, when they can independently elect people outside the Democratic and the Republican Party, that's when you'll reach that critical mass. But you're not going to do that with the Green Party and the Republicans and the Democrats, because a lot of those voters in New York, millions of voters in New York, are independent. So it has to be shown that.
Refuse to retool. We refuse to kind of reorganize our political apparatus to achieve goals beyond, we have to win this and we have to win that. We haven't developed strategies. Nobody's talking strategy here. People are just talking the big strategy is to win. So you won. Now what?
You have to have
strategies for all various scenarios that you're likely to encounter. And the parties are rigidly tied to one way of doing things. They're not talking to each other. They're not, finding ways in which they agree and can move in solidarity with each other on particular plans. It's mind-boggling that we are in 2018 and we have the politics of 1818 still in effect. Thank you, Jeff, for your call today. Clara from Philadelphia, how are you? Are you there? Okay, I think we lost Clara. Gwen from New York, you're on the air.
Hey, Trish. Hello. I wanted to... Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Where are the men that are pruning your bushes? I don't hear them. Okay.
Where, what?
I wanted to know where your afternoon men were. The guys that come out and prune and do the gardening. I don't hear them in background today. So something's wrong. When I'm here, those guys, something's wrong. Slow day. Okay. I brought this up at breakfast this morning to a group, and I want Scott Pruitt to pay us back the $4 million that he squandered during this very short period of time. I know that he is probably there. They've talked about this ethics investigation from day one, because, I've been breaking the law since day one. And now he's going to leave, and he spent an enormous amount of money in this very short period of time that he was there. And I don't feel a lot of this money that was spent had nothing to do with his job. It was very expensive travel, taking, first class. It was, of course, the $40,000 telephone booth. And I just don't think that people should get to come in and blow out these huge debts and then walk away from their job. I very much would like to still have them investigate him and, arrest him if need be for the ethics things that he broke, the ethic rules or laws that he broke. I just think it's intolerable to ask the American people to you know, pick up the tab of $4 million. Can you imagine going into a job and spending $4 million in like a year? Like, who does that?
I mean, there's only so much blame that you could cast on him. His boss thought it was okay.
Yes. His, right.
His boss, the president, exempted him from, absolved blame for everything that he did. Didn't see a reason to fire him at all. Didn't see a reason to subject him to, you know, ethics investigations. Because, frankly, this is a trademark. It has become the trademark of the Trump administration. Everybody seems to be a thief. Everybody seems to be, you know, a kleptocrat.
We hired the whole mafia, the entire mafia, to go in from every group in the whole world, because they're all, everybody's represented in the United States of mafia. We just, and maybe this stuff was going on behind the scenes before, but I think it's so offensive because it's, you know, it's really in your face. And the reason why I do bring it up is I know that the president gave him the green light and even gave him the keys to the car and said, you know, drive as long as you want and as fast as you want. But there are still checks and balances in places, and maybe this is where some of our Democrats could pick up a little credibility by staying on top of this and not just allowing him to walk away until we bring the next thief in to keep doing this. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if anybody's listening.
Let me ask you, why do you think he got away with all of these wrongdoings for so long?
Because I think
fact that, you know, he had protection in the form of the president's support. But what else could this have been?
I think that he was pushing policies for big businesses, and that is what the United States government is there for. They are there to facilitate business for big businesses in this country, and that is it. So as long as he was willing to take the slings and arrows for some terrible, terrible policies that he pushed through, and the next guy is going to keep going. But these guys, I mean, let's face it. I mean, they're complete everybody knows they're charlatans. They're being put in there for exactly one purpose, and that is to destroy the EPA. And so as long as they're willing to take the hits, and I mean, over and over again, he said that he felt that he was in danger. You know, maybe he was in danger. I mean, because he's endangering us, you know, I mean, he's taking the ship and pushing it up against all the boulders and the rocks so that he sinks our ship. I mean, and only for a handful of extremely wealthy people that are so insane that even the fact that the planet is melting down is not going to get to them. The only thing they care about is their money. So I understand that. But, you know, as long as the Democrats are up there, or somebody, I don't care who it is, can, you know, they're in their jobs, and it's very hard to get to that job. It's very hard to get to be have that stroke of luck that young lady had. She's very good, but it took a lot of luck too to get to that place. And when she gets there, she's going to have a lot of rough water ahead of her. But we still have these buttheads in office, and I just hope that maybe one of them is listening. That's really the truth of the matter. I'm hoping maybe somebody's listening to your show today. Maybe they accidentally turned on some ethical reporting and decided to listen to you, and that they'll hear that people are out here, and I am not okay, and I'm sure that most other Americans are not okay with just flipping the bill for some little brat that comes in and decides to, like, piss my money away.
That's what this whole administration is communicating. It has no concern about how people feel about what they're doing, even though it is abundantly clear. Like this guy Mnuchin with his new wife going on a jaunt with a military airplane and, you know, flying first class. And I mean, this is an amazing thing, but this is how Trump and his children and his best friends, this is how they operate.
I mean,
the government still is one big cash cow.
Did you ever think you'd have some guy in one of the highest offices known as the Mooch and the heat was going to fly on. Now, listen, I just want you to know the mooch is out there, and you better give him some respect. I mean, it's amazing to me. It just blows my mind. So I just wanted to put that out into the public airwaves today. I don't know if anybody will hear it, but I just wanted to say that, you know, I don't think, you know, a friend of mine answered me this morning by saying, well, you know, there are so many others in this cabinet have done the same thing. Well, I don't really care how many people are doing it. It's wrong every time. And at least I'd like to get it on record as I object. You know, I just want to say that I object to this. I don't know how much, how far your airwaves go, but maybe somebody will hear it. And maybe some other people will, you know, just keep saying what I'm saying. Go ahead and parrot it, because it's important that we raise this issue that, you know, people are working too hard and making so little money in this country that it's sickening to watch these insecure little babies just trying to validate themselves through the dollar, you know, as much money as they can spend because they have like nothing. They're so low to the ground that they have nothing except for that to lean on.
I tell you. Thank you so much, Gwen, for your call today. Ali from New York, you're on the air.
Hi, you, Therese. How are you doing?
Okay. How's by you?
Well, you know, this is New York. What can I tell you? A lot of things going on. You heard what happened at the Statue of Liberty. And we do have an occupation here, which I'm going to stop by it, later on tonight. So, but I actually called because I wanted to make a comment about, you know, that immigration, the ICE, and taking away those kids and all that. But I just wanted to say something about Alexandria Ocasio. One of the things that if she wins, because this is something else, you know, we just had, she won the primary, but, you know, we don't know if she's going to win to go to Washington. She's going to need somebody who belongs to that group that she belongs to, because, like, I think it was Wayne, she said that it's going to be very difficult for her. You know, it's going to be very difficult for her to really come in, beating somebody, a Crowley, and then be accepted by, you know, the Democratic machine. So let's just see what's going to happen. And another thing is, you and Wayne, the two of you, they were laughing. Yeah, we could laugh now, but I think some years from now, we're not going to be laughing at what these things that's going on in this country. This morning, and this is what I wanted to say. This morning, my son called me up and told me, "Oh, I'm watching MSNBC, and I'm watching this lady Mika. I think her name is Mika Brzezinski. I think it is. She has a show. I think, yeah, yeah." And he said that he told me that she was talking about that situation with taking the kids away, and then she was criticizing Ivanka, and he said that she was right on point. And then he went to say, this is what my son said, you know, that the people that support Trump, he has a rating right now, an acceptable rating, about 84%. So I went, and then he said, this is the thing that it really, really got me upset, was I wish that Hillary Clinton were the president at this moment. I wish that she could, you know, people have voted for her and she could have been there. And I said to him, it really got me upset. I said, you know what? I'm really happy that she's not the president. Because, you know, one thing that it has done to this country is to see the evil, how evil this government is, and it has put it out there. I told him, I said, you know, the people that are supporting Trump, they are descendants of the same people that they used to celebrate, and you just see them in pictures when people, they used to be lynched. Those are descendants of the same people. So I'm glad that people around the world could get to see how evil most of these people are right now. taking these kids away. And then I went to, we talk about it, how it wasn't only these, you know, these people that they come through the border, how it was done during the slavery and how it was done also to the Native American, which they're still taking kids from them.
Mm-hmm.
This government is still, and I have my own experience with that, with a group that it came into New York, and I think I explained that before, where this young couple, they had three kids, two boys and one girl. The girl was at that time 3 years old. They took those three kids away from that family, and they raped. The little girl was already raped. And the kids, they weren't given back to that family. So this is something that is going on in this country. That people, they only see one side. We only see what is happening at the border. But we should see what is happening to the Native Americans and in what is happening around the world. Look, he was talking about invading, going into Venezuela. So do you mm-hmm. think that the Venezuelan people going to just take United States sitting down? There would be a lot of people, a lot of kids killed. And this is what's going on. All these, a lot of these people, they're descendants of the same people that they were celebrating when people used to be lynched. And now we are
armed. We have long history. We have a long history as a nation of unspeakable cruelty. And you wonder, where could these people have gotten these values from? And why is it that with the passage of so much time, you would think that they would revise the way they do things? Because it's just not right, you know. Even as we talk about immigration, nobody's talking about white undocumented people coming through Canada, coming through JFK, coming through Saginaw. The problem has been situated as such that when we talk about so-called illegal immigration, we're talking about Mexicans. And we know it's not true. In fact, a group of about 18 legal organizations have joined together to make exactly that point, that the immigration policies of this administration on their face are just pure racist, purely racist. Have we had any discussions about white undocumented people coming from Eastern Europe? No. And they're coming through every single day through the Canadian border. At John F. Kennedy Airport, I know myself because I've seen it. People come from Eastern Europe and they're met at the airport with all the necessary documentation and papers that they need to get on public assistance and food stamps right away. There's no waiting. There are centers specifically set up. You can't go there. They're set up, the Hasidic community has its own centers that process Hasidic Jews. You can't go there. And they process them for food stamps and subsidized housing and everything. And that's for them specifically. Nobody else could go there. This has been going on for at least 20, 30 years. So we ought to know by now that this is being used, especially by Trump, you know, that disdain and contempt that he has for people of color generally, and certainly for people who are poor. And this is what they intend to use. This is going to be the crucible of the development of the same Nazi-like mentality that is supposed to be spread all over the country and possibly even the world. You make an example of the least of the most vulnerable, I should say, populations. You make an example. And that's why they took the children away. They had no intention of giving them back. They took the children away so that this would be an issue that would go on and on and on, and Trump can come to time and again to remind America, look at what they're doing to our country. I'm waiting to see when people will stand up and confront him, and they're beginning to. But let's look at the contrasting part of it. You know, you're not building a wall on the northern border. So that means there's no problem there. You can deal and you can tolerate illegal immigration from the northern border. But we're not having anything at all. We're not tolerating any immigration from the southern border. Amazing. Thanks, Ali, for your call. David, you're on the air from Brooklyn.
Good afternoon, Eutrice. A couple of things. I am responding to the caller that talked about the excessive spending of certain cabinet offices and whatnot. But that pales in the face of the fact that we have near $1 trillion budget for wasteful military expenditures and intelligence expenditures of amount of over $1 trillion a year. So I don't want to get focusing on something like that as an issue, because evidently what he did in terms of expensive travel expenditures was legal. What I really want to talk about today is what's going on here in New York with the so-called elite high schools at Stuyvesant, Bronx Science, and Brooklyn Tech. And I want to compliment the agent community who have done very well in playing the game. You know, that's the title of my book, Playing the Game. And they have learned how to play the game very well, because most of the students in those schools are from the Asian community, and they've learned to play the game, and they do the things that are necessary to ace or near ace this one examination that is given for entrance into those schools. Now, the thing that I'm not sure of, and maybe you know something about it, who was the group that made it a state law, or proposed it as a state law, to have this just one test for entrance into these three schools? I would think it was mostly generated by European Americans who thought that would give them some advantage. And so what's going on now seems to me that the Asians have turned the tables on them. So that is one thing that I see. Now, maybe you know something. I can't remember during that time when they passed that ruling, a law, and your memory is probably better than mine, being a journalist that you are, how that was gotten through the state legislature. So what we're seeing now is that there's a move by de Blasio and some people in the city to change things, and they're getting some resistance from the Asian community because they've learned to play the game, and now the rules of the game are being changed.
Well, you know, with the so-called elite schools, which were meant to be feeder schools into the more elite colleges and universities, again, the racial game was played. You did have a preponderance of European students, white students. But the population changed. There was a big shift in the population. But they did not want to allow blacks in. So they settled for the happy medium, which was the Asian community. And the Asian community gave them two things. One, because they could defend the quality of education, the Asian students were getting higher grades and excelling. So it allayed the fears of whites that, okay, even if we have to give up our dominance of these schools, at least we are still in league with our equals, intellectual equals. But then again, there was the shift. The shift also was endorsed by the unions. The teachers' union, they didn't object to any of this at all. The administrative changes that went on to facilitate this shift in the schools, rather than opening them up to all communities of the city, they still were selective in the admissions process. And then they defended it by saying, well, look at the grades. The Asian students are coming in with the grades that we like to see, and they're maintaining these grades once they get in. So what is your problem? The issue was at the other time, at another time, you know, why is it that we could only get these schools functioning at that level when the budget should allow all schools to be functioning at a particular level? We have these schools. Well, that was a byproduct of an elite system. It was working just fine. The Bronx High School of Science, Brooklyn Tech, and what was the other one again?
Stuyvesant.
Stuyvesant High School. These schools were absolutely not open to people of color. They were assurances to the elites of New York City that their children could be assured, a very high level education. And that education being one of the resources that are used to control social situations, these schools were dedicated to those populations that were seen as the better people of the city of New York. Their children went to these schools. It was only recently, very recently, I'm talking about in historical time, that you're seeing more and more students of color. Not too many more, but certainly more than used to be, at these schools. At these, we considered them elite schools. But the argument still is, why shouldn't Boys and Girls High School be functioning at that level? Why is it that we have to have these super schools for, you know, people who could afford to send their children there? Because it was like, you know, for the elites, even if they have to buy their children into those schools, you have people like the president talking about it. I went to Wharton. It sure as hell doesn't show. But it was a way to, that the elite assured their children passage into their, you know, the world of entitlement. So you get out, and simply because your resume says Wharton, you're good to go. You've beaten half of the problem. simply by having that on your resume. You may be the dumbest person in Wharton, but it says Wharton. So in a city where the population shifts are occurring very dramatically, like New York, and they're becoming more, again, they're returning to rigidity, a kind of class and race rigidity, you will have a scramble for these kinds of resources. The thinking on the part of the people is that everybody is entitled to an education like that. But then on the flip side of the coin, if everybody had an education like that, then what's the point of competition? What's the point? So you have to maintain these rigid distinctions between those who have and those who do not have, those who are smart and those who are just average, those who will be tomorrow's leaders and those who will be consigned to a life of following. That's it. And that's the story in every major city. The resources are being realigned to suit the vision of the future, not too far in the future either. The vision of the future has to do with which class or which classes will be in positions of power. And all of the resources that you can direct toward that happening, to making it happen, that's what you do. So whereas at Stuyvesant, there is no fight over whether, you know, they get the proper books at the average school in Bedford-Stuyvesant, the fight is a daily fight. Teachers still have to pitch in and throw in their own money to buy supplies. Well, that brings us to the end of our program. I hear the music in the background. Thank you all for calling in and making such valuable contributions to our discussion today. I really enjoy that. I really enjoy connecting with you at this level. Have yourselves a great weekend. Rest up. Take it easy. Don't go crazy. Don't let them make you go crazy. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Alternative Visions with Dr. Jack Rasmus, and we'll see each other Monday. Bye-bye.